Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And we just want to appreciate everybody who's taken time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. If you have some observations you would like to make during the course of the show with the rest of the usual suspects, that's a great place to do it. Or if there is a question you would like for us to address to our guest during the course of the show and you don't think we're quite headed that way, go ahead and roll it into the chat room. Both my co-host and I will be monitoring the chat room during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to pick up your ideas and just fold them right in. And if you have to leave to take care of some business halfway through and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you want to listen to some previous episodes of Midrats, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the long-term view and the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or at Stitcher. Now let's hop right into our show. And what we want to talk about today is we want to look at what we as a nation need to think about in terms of meeting the national security requirements of our country in the years to come. Look at what direction we are headed in right now and where we need to emphasize, whether it's intellectual, material, or conceptually, in order to successfully meet those needs from a military perspective. We also want to discuss perhaps some false horizons that are out there that are attractive, that might distract us from the best path to go forward, and what are those important areas that we seem to be either ignoring or forget about over thousands of years of military history. And we are honored today to have on for the full hour just a superior guest to discuss this and other related issues. And we're going to be using as a base or a touchstone during the course of the show his latest book, Scales on War, The Future of America's Military Risk. And the author and guest is Major General Bob Scales, U.S. Army retired. Major General Scales, he commanded units in Korea and the United States and two units in Vietnam. During the Vietnam War, he received the Silver Star for action during what is commonly known as the Battle for Hamburger Hill. He's been intimately involved with issues related to the military. Many people should be familiar with him, both on TV and with the written word. He completed his service as Commandant of the Army War College. Bob, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys. This is terrific. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Yes, sir, and I would recommend everybody go ahead and click on the link you can find on the show page to the latest book. It's a easily digestible tome, and one thing that it set the hook early for me is when I was reading the preface. And believe it or not, there are people who actually read books, but they don't read the preface. I've never understood that, but it's true. But at the very end, and this book was published in 2016, last year. And I'll just do a little extended long quote for you to kind of set the table. At the end of the preface, beginning of long quote, the idea that a nation doesn't really care about those who do the dirty day-to-day business of killing the enemy haunts me to this very day. This will be my last book. I had to write it to atone for my sins and to try to awaken our national leaders to the need to keep those who perform the act of intimate killing alive in combat. I'm not optimistic. Jim Mattis is retired. This nation is tired of watching war on television. What the Defense Department really wants is to buy big, expensive stuff that floats and flies, and ISIS is on the march, undoing the brave work done by hundreds of thousands of soldiers and Marines in Iraq. But here goes anyway. And by the way, Jim, thanks for trying. End of long quote. Well, since you wrote the book, We've had an election, and as a byproduct, we find ourselves at the end of January of 2017, and Jim Mattis is the Secretary of Defense. And as somebody who has talked to him a lot and knows him well, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk to the listener about how you see Jim Mattis, the leader and the man as you know him, coming to the position of Secretary of Defense, and you've seen many Secretary of Defense over the course of the years. And what do you think that he can bring to the challenge of that position as he is given a great opportunity to serve our nation once again?
Well, you know, that quote that you read, I wrote probably, gosh, I don't know, back in April or May of last year when I was finishing the manuscript, and I was 100% sure that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election, as many people were. And I guess a lot of the pessimism of the book and also the pessimism of the quote that you just quoted was based on the premise that that warriors would have in the Clinton administration would have very little to do with the formulation of our national policy. And at the time I wrote it, I had absolutely no clue that Jim Mattis would wind up being the Secretary of Defense. And had I known that or even intimated that, I probably would have written less of a pessimistic a book about the future of national security. You know, I have so many Mattis stories, but I think, as you know, I have a PhD in military history, and Jim has a level of knowledge of military history that goes far beyond, you know, sort of postdoctoral knowledge. And when we first met back in 2004 and 5, we used to talk about military history, and he's so intimately involved. And so I gave him a copy of a book I just finished. The book was called The Iraq War. He'd already consumed a book called Yellow Smoke, which is really, reading the book was the reason that he contacted me. And the book he gave me in return was a biography of Cicero. Really, Cicero. And he said, and I don't remember the page, but he said, he called me General Bob. He said, "General Bob, I want you to read the quote on page, whatever it was, 142 or whatever." And I read the quote, and the quote was essentially about the role of a soldier, citizen, in the Republic of Rome, and how important it was for a soldier to commit his life to the defense of the Republic. But after the emergency was over, to put his, you know, his body armor and his helmet and his sword on the wall and go back to doing his business. And to this day, I'll never forget that moment when I read that quote and I thought to myself, holy cow, this is one incredibly remarkable man. And who knew? And one other quick point, which I'll make, which is hilarious. Back just before Christmas, when the book really started to take off, one of my media friends asked me, he said, "General, how in the heck did you turn out a book that quick dedicated to Mattis? How in the world did you make that happen?" In other words, he just presumed that the dedication of the book and the idea that I devoted pretty much a whole chapter to Mattis, he presumed was just based on my own overzealous ambition to influence the course of the Department of Defense. What a crazy world we live in today, don't we?
Well, let's talk a little bit about influencing the course of the Department of Defense. And your book is an homage to the American infantryman. And in a lot of ways, being a naval officer, I don't always get into the people down in the mud and stuff, but I understand a lot of the things, I think. I really liked your concept. There shouldn't be any fair fights, and that we have underserved our infantry forces, both Marine and Army, in providing them with the equipment and tools so that their fights are never fair. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit in terms of the context of our 21st century wars?
Yeah, you know, quite a few of the reviews of my book have criticized me because they say that I'm a little bit too passionate about a small part of the Department of Defense. Actually, if you want to know the percentage, it's about 4% of our men and women in uniform, or what some people would call intimate killers, those who go to war with a specific mission of closing with and destroying the enemy. And I say, well, that's a little overzealous. But frankly, I don't think so. I think from my study and the writing I've done in the past that that's absolutely not true, that those who do this business can't be contracted out. They can't be easily recruited in wartime because mom and dad don't want their son to march off to war. Over the last 75 years or so, 81%, 4 out of 5 of every person serving in uniform who was killed at the hands of the enemy. Now, this is not due to disease or accidents, but killed at the hands of the enemy were infantry. And yet we live in a society where this body of, frankly, mostly men who do intimate killing receive less than 1% of the DOD budget. So it would just seem to me when I wrote the book that maybe those who make more likely to make the ultimate sacrifice, those who the enemy wants to kill as a first priority, ought to receive more attention from their government. And they don't. And oh, by the way, this proportion hasn't changed in 75 years. When I was in Vietnam, you know, before inflation, the cost to equip an infantryman was about $2,000. Today, it's about $20,000. $20,000. When an F-35 costs $110 million and it's flown by one man, we have a cadre of intimate killers who basically receive an incredibly small part of the federal government, and yet the federal budget, and yet our government turns around and asks these men to be the ones most likely, you know, to die in combat. To me, it just doesn't make sense.
Early on in your book, you raised a character that I automatically felt guilty I did not know more about. And what if you could take a moment and discuss who exactly is the Imperial Japanese Colonel Hiromichi Yahara, and how did he help define the American era of war?
Yeah, I actually I didn't know the guy either. I just picked up a book in a bookstore. I think I paid a buck for it, and it was a book written by Colonel Yahara. And I spent virtually all day reading this, and I thought to myself, "Holy smokes, this is the man who basically invented or understood, if you will, the nature and character of the American way of war." Just so our audience knows, Yahara was Deputy Chief of Staff of the Japanese 32nd Army, defending the island of Okinawa between April and June of 1945. His boss was Lieutenant General Cho, who was an arrogant, typical samurai, a Japanese officer of limited intellect. But Yahara had been commandant of the Imperial Japanese War College, which of course endeared him to me. He had served as an attaché in the United States and spoke pretty much perfect English. He was imperious, a very tall, aquiline man. And his purpose was to serve General Cho, but to come up with the means for the Japanese military to defend effectively against the inevitable American invasion of the Japanese home island. And he was to put together lessons learned that he would then use to educate the Japanese Army on how to do this. He so when the Japanese withdrew into the island and the senior officers prepared to commit ritual seppuku, General Cho turned to General Yahara and said, "No, you're not going to commit suicide. You're going to escape to Japan." So they dressed him up in a fisherman's garb. He paddled off to back to Japan, and sadly, he was captured by the Americans after 3 days, put in an internment camp, and he lived until 1972. Isn't it interesting? He died the very year that the American military stopped combat operations in Vietnam. And so over that intervening few decades, he wrote a series of books that tried to explain to the world the American, the nature and character of the American era of warfare and how to defeat it. And the tenets that he came up with in this book are immutable. And here's the main one. Here's what he said. He said the way to beat Americans is not to challenge them with technology, not to beat them in the air and on the sea, but simply to kill Americans. Not to kill Americans as a means to an end, but to kill Americans as an end in itself. You know, he quotes in his book that famous quote from Ho Chi Minh when a French journalist asked him how in the world he ever expected to defeat America's, the dominant military power in the world. And he said, "They will kill 100 of us. We will kill one of them, and they will tire of it first." In other words, he knew that the center, vulnerable center of gravity of America was dead Americans. And the way to beat America is to kill enough of them till the American public and public opinion tires of it, and the United States either withdraws or draws themselves down to the point when they are no longer a significant influence on the course of warfare. And then he goes down a laundry list of those things that enemies of the United States should use to kill Americans and win the war on their terms. Such things as hiding, going to ground, mingling amongst the people, of finding ways to mitigate the killing effect of American firepower. Does any of this sound familiar? All of this came from this brilliant mind of this Japanese officer who, 75 years ago, understood what America was all about and how over time the rest of the world could defeat the United States. And here's what's so interesting. Yahara's principles still apply regardless of the level of war, whether it's high-end war in Korea or perhaps the Arab-Israeli war, all the way down to minor insurgencies. The way to beat us is to kill us in large proportion till we get tired of it and go home.
Well, I think you also point out in the book that our enemies are adaptive. We've in order to mitigate the effects of the actions of these enemies on our troops, we've gone to trying to kill them remotely, bombing them from a high altitude, sending in guided missiles of various kinds. But ultimately, if we're going to, and I think Fehrenbach said this in this kind of war, that we're always going to have people on the ground. And as you go looking at the future, and which is where your book is headed, you've applied lessons learned from science fiction, Ender's Game, and I think I catch traces of Starship Troopers in there. True. I mean, we want troops to be connected to each other, connected back to higher echelons, and to be well equipped to fight on the ground, but not just to fight, but to prevail. Can you discuss? I mean, you've discussed an arc of instability, and you've talked about the rise of ISIS and Hamas and Hezbollah. Can you kind of talk about where we are with these enemies that have learned to adapt to the American way of war as we presently fight it, and what that may mean for our future?
Yeah, that's a great question. What's so interesting, and I say this in the book, is that when we fight the enemy who tries to fight us our way, our enemies are 0-6. These are Western armies that fight, sort of native armies. And that would be the four Arab-Israeli wars, the March to Baghdad and Desert Storm. We crush enemies when they try to do that. But when we fight enemies their way, depending on how you do the math, we're 5-0-2. So the enemy knows that to try to mimic the Western way of war for non-Western societies is a losing proposition. So what do you do? Well, you do what our enemies are doing today. And this is sort of a Darwinian process. This is the hidden hand of war at work here. Because, it's like Clausewitz said, all wars are two-sided contests in which both sides fully intend to win. So the side we fight is the side that's going to follow a method of war that he believes is most likely to lead to success. And it's very interesting if you look at the history of all this. I mean, when was the last time we fought a major sea engagement? With apologies to my naval friends. Well, it was the year I was born, April 1944, at the Battle of Philippine Sea. When was the last time we were seriously contested in the air? In other words, we had to fight for dominance in the air, and that was the Christmas air offensive over North Vietnam in 1972. When was the last time an American infantryman was killed in intimate combat? Well, actually, three were killed yesterday. So if we know that Yahara was right, and if we know that the enemy goes to school on us, and if we know that enemies are spending pennies on the dollar compared to us and still prevailing on the battlefield, what I say in the book is maybe we ought to change our strategy a little bit. Maybe we ought to do whatever we can to make more survivable and more lethal and more successful on the battlefield those who do this dirty business of intimate killing. Well, I mean, what administrations have said since the Truman administration is that, I got that. But the American people are tired of this. We're not going to fight wars like this anymore. We're too smart for that. So the idea of facilitating success among our intimate killers is really a bad deal, because when we go to war next time, we're just not going to fight on the ground. Well, you know what? as a good friend of mine once said, he says, we will never be able to never say we won't do this again. And we will. And we always have. Inevitably, it comes down to that. So all I'm saying in the book is maybe we ought to anticipate the future. Maybe we ought to do things that will keep these guys alive rather than waiting for wars to start and playing catch-up and eventually losing the initiative to those who are perhaps far smarter than us when it comes to fighting these kinds of wars.
One of the areas of the book that I found myself giving a nice evangelical amen to is, because it hit on one of my hobby horses, is one of the best analytical tools I've always thought, if you really want to try to divine the future, is you've got to look back in the past and you've got to know it well. One of my mentors was a retired German Army 4-star, straight out of Central Casting, General Hansen was. And, one thing that he always emphasized to us is from the time that a Roman sat there with his shield, his spear, and his sword to today, what defines everything we do in the military is that infantryman who's standing on a corner and claiming it. And there's inside the Beltway and other places, there is an industrial scale level of people willing to give advice and think tanks, et cetera, and so forth, on and on. And you outline kind of those five analytical schools that keep coming up with ideas that don't quite get the leverage. And when I got through reading about your five analytical schools, and if you wanted to touch on this, fine. If it doesn't, that's okay too. But it reminded me of what I read last week, where the Army has decided that they are going to deactivate their small team reconnaissance units.
Yeah,
company-sized units, three active duty right. that they're going to decommission this year, and the four National Guard last year. And in the middle of the article I read, the thing that jumped out and grabbed me, and I thought of it right when I was reading about the five analytical schools and their views you came from, is this is a quote from the article, quote, this is how they justify their decision. Starting my quote again, computer models were used to conclude long-range surveillance companies were not in demand by ground commanders, unquote. It wasn't discussions with ground commanders. It wasn't recent combat experience. It was computer models. And a sister article talked about
right.
the various algorithms he's come up with. If you could talk about this industry that comes up with this, you know, shiny bright pebble every few years that is trying to reinvent or reconceptualize the hard truth that for thousands of years continues to be set.
Yeah, that's, boy, what a great question. You know, I have a quote in the book, which I really enjoy reciting when I give speeches. And it kind of goes like this. Generals are like bass. They're drawn to bright, shiny objects. And I think that's true in warfare. And one of the great failures of the American defense intellectual industry is our inability to anticipate and forecast the time, the place, the intensity, duration, and the cost of all of our wars. We're like 0-12. And yet we pump tens of billions of dollars into this industry inside the Beltway that seeks to tell us what future wars will be like. And we almost fail. And I ask myself, well, why is that? Well, to your point, there are these wonderful industries out there who have tens of thousands of very attractive 20-something Georgetown MAs who sit around their computers cranking out these wonderful anticipatory documents, none of which ever pan out to be anything. And after they fail, the reward is for the Department of Defense to hire them to do more. And a couple of my favorites is the scenario school. This is the first one. This is a school that says, pick one of your usual suspects, you know, Iraq, North Korea, China, or Russia. Come up with these horrific scenarios about how the world will end if we go to war with them, and then start building machines to be able to fight and to defeat them. It's so interesting that most of the scenarios are built around material-intensive enemies, which, of course, feed the large defense industries who are making ships, planes, missiles, and satellites. My other one is... concepts masquerading as strategies. That's my favorite. I'll just hit on these two. This is the idea that someone will write an article for a journal about some subject, you know, fill it in, net-centric warfare, effects-based operations, air-sea battle, the gift of time. You can run down all of these. The Army as coast artillery. Next thing you know, it achieves notoriety in the blogs. Then it becomes an office in the Pentagon. Pretty soon a general or an admiral is assigned to run it. And next thing you know, there are lines in the budget that support it. And they're not strategies. They're just concepts and ideas that somebody falls in love with. I could go on and on. But at the end of the day, when the bullets start to fly and the president gets his counsel around him and says to them, we have to do something about this, gentleman. People are dying. And inevitably the answer is send in the Army, send in the Marines, send in JSOC. And next thing you know, we're engaged in a ground war that everyone from the commander in chief to think tank gurus all the way down said would never happen again. But it happens again. And when the bullets start to fly, even though, you know, candidate Clinton said, we will never put boots on the ground in a future conflict, we will put boots on the ground. We always do. And inevitably, a young soldier marches off to war poorly equipped, poorly trained, poorly prepared, in too few numbers, with little or no hope of ever having more numbers in this fight, and winds up either wounded or dead, or so, because of so many rotations to the combat zone, so psychologically traumatized that they're never themselves again. When numbers would make a difference. But unfortunately, in our wars in the last 15, 20 years, we've always gone to war with too few soldiers for too many missions.
Big Buck, I made five key points, I thought, on that. You say in there somewhere that in future wars, we can never have too many close combat units. And then
right.
You said that, you know, that the key to high quality units is having older, wiser, not, you
yeah.
know, not 60-year-olds obviously, but older, wiser troops. And then we want to be able to have enough simulations and practice for these guys to form cohesive teams.
Right.
And we want to sort out the eagles and the turkeys, and you might want to address that in a minute. But then the other thing was that you were pointing out that we were still using the M16, which was a crummy rifle in 1972 when I was floating around of Vietnam and long before that, and it's still a crummy rifle. What kind of weaponry should we get to help our guys out and give them what they need? But can you kind of address these things? We need more
sure.
close combat
sure.
units. Older, wiser, and eagles and turkeys to begin with.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me try to go down these. By the way, day before yesterday, I came back from a wonderful 3-day trip to the 1st Marine Division at 29 Palms. And I have to say, if you ever want to boost your morale and feel good about America's military, go to 29 Palms. It was just absolutely amazing. And one of the things I watched was a breaching operation. And this colonel, who I won't mention his name, but who was with me, we were talking about that. And he leaned over to me and he said words to the effect, you know, here comes the hard part. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, it's when we lift the Harrier bombs and we lift the artillery and then we lift the mortars and we've still got another 300 yards to go. And I thought about that. This is yesterday. In fact, I'm in the process of writing an article on that subject, and I said, holy crap, I missed this in my book. It's that 300 yards, isn't it? Whether it's the Somme or whether it's Iwo Jima or whether it's Guadalcanal or whether it's the Ashau Valley. We do really well up to that point where we've got across the deadly zone, the red zone, that 300 yards where the fight is completely equal, where the enemy's weapons are as good, or to your point earlier about the M16, better than ours. And the fires have lifted, the fighter planes have turned to go home, and it's an even fight. And so one of the things that I write about in the book is what technologies or training or all the other things can we apply in a future battlefield that make us dominant, not just up to the 300-yard mark, but from the 300-yard mark to actions after the objective is taken. What technologies do we have out there to do that? Well, I mean, you could say, well, we have machine guns and small arms. Well, no, we don't. The Russians' machine guns are better than ours. Their rifle outranges ours by about 40%. The M16 has a cyclic rate the same as a Russian AK-47, but it's so unreliable, the system is so unreliable, that the actual rate of fire is about 50% less. So when we get in that deadly business of crossing that last 300 yards, not only is it a fair fight, but all too often it's an unfair fight. Now, let me ask you, what's the equivalent in air-to-air combat for an F-35 of the last 300 yards? I would say it's probably 50 to 60 miles. You think the Air Force or the Navy would tolerate an air-to-air missile or a radar or a sensor that gives that advantage to the enemy? No. So why in the world do we give that advantage to the enemies we face? And, oh, by the way, these enemies are PhD candidates at Georgetown. These are illiterate, as I faced in Vietnam, illiterate Vietnamese farmers who just happen to have a better close combat weapon. Somehow or other, that doesn't seem right to me. We have to develop the technologies to remain dominant in that last 300 yards when most Americans die on the battle.
You know, we touched on science fiction a little earlier when we were talking about Ender's Game and Starship Troopers. But as you talked about the things that really are available now that we're just not doing for our infantrymen, I thought back to 31 years ago was when the sequel to Alien came out, Aliens. And not even going with the nuke the site from orbit is the only way to be sure. But when you looked at the fictional Marines of the future that they had in that small platoon, it's amazing how science fiction writers informed themselves and maybe even influenced the future. But you had many of the things that you talked about, the advanced armor that was lightweight and substantial.
Yep.
You had communications
sensors,
not only between individuals,
yep,
but communications back to the command element. The command element had the ability, both audio and visual, and biometrically, seeing what's happening with their body, everybody in their company, and could track it and kept that communications level in real time and up and down the chain of command.
Right.
And if
right.
you could outline some of those technologies that aren't science fiction, they're not from 31 years ago, the future is now, it's been 31 years, that really can make the difference in making sure that our infantry that is going to have to go there isn't going into a fair fight, but is going in there in a dominant fight.
Right. You know, it's very interesting. In the 90s, as a two-star, I was in charge of what was then called the Army After Next Project. The Marine version was something called Sea Dragon. And basically, we were feeding off of Ender's Game and Aliens and Starship Trooper, thinking these are the things that we need to do in order to be dominant. Unfortunately, what happened was we had the ideas before we had the technologies. And so we tried too soon to implement these ideas without the technologies. Fast forward 25 years later, in 2017, I'm sitting here talking on a cell phone that was only an imaginary device 25 years ago. But micro miniaturization and the ability to miniaturize precision and the ability to build soldier networks and cellular networks have fundamentally changed the prospects of young soldiers to do extraordinary things in close combat. But what's happened is the generation after us were so disappointed and so jaded by the inability of primitive technologies to meet the promise of the concepts that we developed that too often within DOD folks have just walked away from it. And very quickly, let's just walk down these. You know, in Vietnam, in 1967, the air-to-air kill ratio over Vietnam was 1-1. It's an embarrassment. It was 13-1 in Korea. And the researchers found out that the problem wasn't technological, but it was human. That 92% of all the pilots shot down over Vietnam were shot down in their first four missions. So the thought was, let's find a way to give pilots the experience of four missions bloodlessly, and that led, as you all know, to Red Flag and Top Gun. And as soon as particularly the Navy nailed down this idea of the OODA loop and the ability experientially to get better at the enemy bloodlessly, that ratio went from 1-1 to 7-1 very quickly. So why don't we have a small unit, Red Flag or Top Gun? Why don't we have the ability to give young members of an infantry squad their first four firefights free? Why do soldiers and Marines have to die in order to figure out who's got the tactical right stuff or who's got the ability to make the right decisions and to keep their soldiers and Marines alive. That's one. The second one really has to do with the most important technological breakthrough that can change the character of close combat, and that's unmanned vehicles, drones, robots and drones. If we can kill the enemy bloodlessly over the horizon, if we can see, if a squad can look out and see everything around them out to 400 meters or 1,000 meters would be ideal, then the days of snipers and ambushes and movements to contact and IED emplacements and all those things, all those killers of Americans would go away. So my question in the book is, why don't we do that? The technology is there. These aren't F-35s. They're plastic model airplanes. And the third thing, which I think is important, is this whole idea of a soldier network. You know, most soldiers, most units that break in combat don't break when soldiers die. They break when small units break psychologically. It's this fear of violent death and battlefield isolation that makes a soldier take counsel of his fears and break and run. SLA Marshall discovered this in the hedgerows of Normandy in World War II. So let's say that every soldier could communicate and talk to his buddy. We have teenagers that tweet 1,000 times a day, but you put a soldier in combat, the most fearsome environment any human being can think of, and he's alone. That's not right. Give him the ability to talk to his buddy, to have that virtual touch of the sleeve. If we could do that, then we could sustain units in combat. And you mentioned this earlier. Let's say we could find out when soldiers culminate. Let's say we have the ability to take his biometric measurements, galvanic skin response, respiration, heartbeat, and eventually the ability to measure brain waves. So we could determine when a soldier is about to culminate psychologically and pull him out of the line and send in the reserves. Think how that would preserve the emotional stability and the courage of a young soldier in close combat. We could do that today. The NFL does it today. Why can't we do that on the battlefield? And the final point I think you mentioned is the idea of weapons. Weapons aren't rocket science. Weapons are weapons. But we're able to miniaturize now precision such that a tank gun with all its computers in the Gulf War, that same technology can be put in a piece of plastic that weighs 2.5 ounces. An anti-aircraft battery that 30 years ago took up 40 acres of ground, you can now put on the shoulder of an anti-aircraft gunner. An anti-tank a weapon that's able to kill out to 4,000 or 5,000 meters can be placed on the shoulder of a young infantryman. All these technologies, and oh, by the way, small arms. There's no reason why we can't be dominant in small arms. A rifle costs, what, $1,000, maybe top end? We could replace every rifle with a good weapon in the hands of close combat soldiers today for the infantry of the Marines, the Army, and Special Forces for the cost of a single F-35 fighter. If the weapons can keep soldiers alive in close combat, make him dominant in that last 300 yards, why don't we give it to him? That's my question.
One other, I'm going to shift focus here in a second, but one of the other things you pointed out is the fact that we're no longer, because of the media coverage, the narrative has become a major issue in the wars we fight. Can you address that a little bit about the effect of the narrative?
Yeah, that's I learned about the narrative at the feet of the master. I was in 2009-2010, Dave Petraeus asked me to go over to look at those cutting edge technologies that might make a difference in combat. And I remember having dinner with him one night, and I says, well, what do you think is a dominant function from your perspective? And he said, oh, it's very similar, Bob. He says, controlling the narrative. Because all too often in warfare today, it's not what happens on the battlefield that determines national security policy. It's what's perceived to happen on the battlefield. It's the ability of the media. It's the ability information warfare that soldiers fight today that make a difference in whether a country stays with the fight or leaves early. You know, it's graphic depictions of dead Americans, graphic depictions of innocents who may or may not have been killed by American firepower, amplify the effects of what Colonel Yahara talked about 25 years ago. Remember now, it wasn't until 1940, even got a peek at the huge sacrifices that American soldiers and Marines were making on the battlefield, and it horrified Americans. Well, amplify that today by a factor of what? 100? Social media, an American media that's essentially hostile to the American use of force on the battlefield, and our enemies. Russia has become a master at misinformation and turning the narrative around, so that now a soldier, when he goes into combat, has lurking over his shoulder the fear that if he fires short, if he puts a round into a village, the enemy will amplify that and put that soldier on the evening news. And the rate at which the American people get disenchanted with the war, with warfare, close combat, is amplified by the graphic nature of the media today. Look at the pictures that we've seen coming out of Aleppo or other places in Syria. Think of the incredible effect that has on the decision making or on the decisions that are made by Western powers. And this is what Dave was talking about. He said, we not only have to fight our enemy, but we have to fight our enemy literally in the Klieg lights of videographers that may or may not be official, transmitted all over the world in millimicroseconds. And so it's not the act so much in future warfare that determines our national strategy. It's perception of the act, which can be much, much more damaging to our forces in the future.
That's another one of the undercurrents that the reader can find throughout your book on Scales on War. We haven't mentioned it this half hour, so there we go. That's what we're talking about, is Scales on War. And a couple things. I'm going to bounce all over the place, but it does go back, I think, to you really have to look at institutional mindsets that really are better informed not by charts or graphs or numbers, but by a psychiatrist. You bring up in the book,
right,
the human element, the role of social sciences. You have psychocultural war. You just touched on it a bit. And though I'm going to go off on a shiny object here, if you could, let's not end the show without you talking again about a term I think everybody should be familiar with, because it describes what a lot of us know inherently. That's palliation. But there's a section of your book that when I first saw it, I got excited because I thought it was going to be about Marine Corps Colonel John Ripley. But you have a section of the book called Ripley's Ghost, and it also covers a mindset. It's a very different Ripley in American history. But a lot of the challenges that you bring up in the book, for instance, I thought, and there was a brief moment of a couple years after 9/11 where there was some real talk that we might actually get rid of the 9mm, might actually get rid of the 5.56, but that was all crushed by the heavy dead hand of what I call the green eye shade people. But
right,
under Ripley's Ghost, you talk about Union General James Wolfe Ripley and his mindset and how that mindset has some staying power in our military. Who was General Ripley and what does he represent?
Now, that's a great question. General Ripley was a chief of ordnance for the Union Army in the Civil War. He was probably the most diabolically evil human being, probably responsible for more battlefield deaths than any general in American history. And he was a troglodyte. He represented then a phenomenon, sadly, that's still with us today, that fighter pilots and carrier commanders can handle technology. But for whatever reason, he believed that soldiers can't. And so he was the one that stopped virtually, through an act of crass insubordination, stopped Lincoln from proliferating repeating rifles to the Union Army. Some historians have said, and I think rightfully, that had the Spencer or the Sharps or the Henry or the Winchester repeating rifles been put in the hands of Union troops in 1862, perhaps 150,000 lives on both sides of the Civil War could have been saved. But Ripley believed in the following, and I ask our listeners if any of this sounds familiar. It goes like this. Infantrymen can't handle complexity. The Springfield muzzle-loading rifle, you put a bullet down the barrel, you ram it home, you put a fulminate of mercury cap on it, pull the trigger, that's all you got to. If we have to give soldiers the complex mechanism with a lever or a bolt or a drop block, they won't be able to handle it. That's myth number one. Myth number two, if you give the soldiers a repeating rifle, they'll just shoot up all their ammunition. So it's better, believe it or not, he actually said this, it's better to have a slow-firing weapon where the soldiers will have to manipulate it and can't shoot faster than 3 rounds a minute. Otherwise, the soldiers will shoot up all their ammunition. And the third thing is, you know what, really? Soldiers really can't aim and shoot. Soldiers, infantrymen, really are just too dumb to, you know, to take careful aim, to engage the enemy, or to follow fire commands. So their officers have to be able to tell them how to fight at the tactical level. He believed all this stuff. But before you get too mad at Ripley, everybody stop for a minute and think of the two world wars, Korea, in my own case, in Vietnam. Do you realize that the American Army only 4 years ago authorized full automatic fire for the M4? Can you believe that? The Germans allowed it in 1944, the Russians, the AK-47 in 1947. Every other army in the world, perfectly comfortable with soldiers firing full automatic, but ours. Why? It's Ripley's ghost. It's our congenital disposition to not trust the intelligence and the initiative and the leadership ability and the discipline of our young soldiers. It's the same thing with this, with the soldier cell phone. Why doesn't every soldier have access to a soldier's network? Why? Well, because people don't trust them with the information. Today, just the same as people didn't trust, like Ripley didn't trust, soldiers in the Civil War and their ability to control their rate of fire. The truth is that soldiers will do what they're taught and what they're led to do. If NCOs and officers control the rate of fire will be controlled. One thing I took out of the article, was the fact that there is an inverse proportion. There's an inverse proportion to the number of rounds that a soldier carries with the eliteness of the unit. JSOC Special Forces soldiers carry fewer rounds than straight leg infantry. Why? Because they're more likely to take aim shots. They're more likely to preserve their ammunition because they understand the world around them. They're more likely to be disciplined in how they maneuver. I'm just saying that today, I believe a lot of the problems that we have with poorly equipped infantry are decisions made by our military hierarchy that are based on the premise that we don't trust our soldiers.
That's an interesting point. Early on, I want to segue slightly from that because you were talking about the leadership. And And you discuss in the book sort of some kind of selection process to select those people to be leaders or to be in these combat units that can intuitively think under pressure, and react to that. And I'm really interested in that point, because it seems to me that, just based on my experience, a lot of people who flew airplanes or drove ships had no situations at all. They didn't last long on the job, but it's the situational awareness, the ability to think on your feet. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit in terms of this you're making?
Boy, this is a very important question. It's something I guess I discovered not through the Army, but I've discovered through the writings of people like Gary Klein from Harvard and Marty Seligman and Angela Duckworth from the University of Pennsylvania, others who have discovered the power of intuition. This struck me like a thunderbolt about, 15 years ago when I first ran across it. And it goes like this. Policeman or a fireman or an EMT who is brilliant at his job, how he makes those decisions. And his answer is always the same. Well, it's gut feel. I just did what I thought was right. There was no planning. We soldiers are obsessed with planning. We love the planning, MDMP, the military decision-making process. We're in love with it. But you know what? Like EMTs and firemen and policemen, when a bullet cracks over your head and you go to ground, the processes that you follow to stay alive in combat are completely different than the logical processes you go through in business or in operations to plan. It's intuitive. It's visceral. It comes to you through the primitive part of your brain. It is a caveman who survives an attack by a saber-toothed tiger who never forgets what he had to do to survive that. It's a Darwinian element of our that's baked into our DNA. And what these scientists have discovered is that the science is real. There are some soldiers, some leaders who are really good at intuitive perception and intuitive decision making. This is where I talk about the separation in my book between eagles and turkeys. And you can't anticipate it just from the perception of an individual. The guy may be a West Pointer, an Annapolis graduate. He may have played football. He may have married the admiral's daughter. But you don't know how good that leader is at intuitive decision making and intuitive sort of fingertip, a touch perception of the battlefield, court sense, I guess is the word I'd use, until you put him in a simulation and test his ability to make those intuitive decisions. And unfortunately today, we don't, even though we could, we don't have the devices that, number one, find those with this tactical right stuff, and number two, improve their ability to do intuitive decision-making. Simulations that subject a soldier hundreds of times to differing situations and sharpen his ability to react and think on their feet. And this is what keeps soldiers alive in close combat, not their ability to go through some complex planning sequence.
We're about out of time. One thing I wanted to ask you about is you put in the intro of the book that this is your last book, and you've been involved for decades, not just on active duty, but even while you're on active duty, but after active duty, in person, TV, radio, print, both books and articles, very intimately involved in our military and its future. And when I was reading, and obviously writing your last book is emotional. It has to be. And There's an emotional thread throughout the whole book, and I was trying to get my hands around it. And originally I thought it might be a type of anger, but it wasn't that. And then I thought it might have been a frustration. I was like, no, that's not really it either. And about halfway through the book, I realized that there's some variation, almost a heartbreak in the book when you're writing about a lot of the issues. And even though this is the last book, if the listener wanted to keep a handle or wanted to wonder if you were going to write about other things, are you still going to be engaged in the conversation? Are you just going to be looking at different venues? Where could the listener look or listen to if they wanted to get your opinion in the future?
Boy, that's a great question. Well, of course, remember, I wrote this book based on the premise that we would have another Democratic administration. I never in my wildest dreams ever thought that Jim Mattis and those like Jim Mattis would be moving into positions of consequence in the DOD. Based on that, maybe I would have rewritten some of this. But your perception is spot on. At the end of the day, I have in the back of my mind the idea, really, when you cut to the chase, in our country at least, nobody really cares. You know, they say we support the soldier, thank you for your service. But when you look at what people actually do, it just isn't there. Let me just leave you with one quick anecdote, which came out of a friend of mine writing a piece. A few years ago, a dog food company went to an advertiser and saying, sell my dog food. They came up with jingles. They came up with testimonials from dog owners. They came up with scientific proof. They came up with a wonderful set of videos that described the dog food, and the dog food never sold. And finally, the dog food maker turned to the advertiser and said, what went wrong? And the advertiser said, man, the dogs don't like it. And my concern is, to this day, is that I can be as passionate as I can possibly be. But at the end of the day, inside the Beltway, those who make the key decisions and write the checks and develop strategies about the future and try to anticipate how America's wars will go, when it comes to the individual soldier and Marine and special operator, at the bottom of the day, the dogs just don't like it.
And that is a very sobering point, and I think, unfortunately, you're probably spot on with that. But this has been, regardless of that, sir, this has been a great hour. I really appreciate you taking time with us today to talk about, again, for the listener, Major General Bob Scales, U.S. Army Retired, latest book, Scales on War, Future of America's Military at Risk. It's an important book, and as we mentioned a couple of times, I saw a few names and a few references there. It's going to, as all good books, it's going to lead me to go grab a couple of other ones. So thank you very much. I appreciate it, Bob.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks a lot, General. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much for our listeners for joining us for another edition of Midrat. And until we see you next week, I hope everybody has a great Navy and, for our guest, Army Day. Cheers.
Hello!